Yeah.
All right, good morning. Welcome to the frigid confines of the auditorium. We're here to discuss ultra-energy cosmic rays this week. So here's a cosmic ray shower coming down and hitting an array of detectors on the ground. And I will be discussing the Pierre Auger Observatory, reporting on recent progress, giving some perspectives. And I was asked also, to my surprise, on the program to provide declassified results. And I wasn't sure what that meant exactly. So I went to the experts on declassification, and there are clear guidelines you can look up for how to declassify things. So here's what you've all been waiting for. Here's the declassified Auger energy spectrum. So the Auger data is in there somewhere in red. And here is a sky map. So here are all the results you wanted to see. Having said this, let me apologize in advance. Yesterday we saw beautiful results from Stefan on high-res analyses. These are mature, completed analyses, and you will see nothing of the kind here for Auger. We are planning to be submitting results at this summer's conferences, particularly the ICRC. So we're still finalizing a lot of these analyses, so we have nothing final to present here today. Well, what I'll do instead is quickly go over some of the issues surrounding the study of UHE cosmic rays, make the case for a hybrid observatory. This is preaching to the choir for this audience here. And then I'll describe the Auger Observatory, how we got to where we are today, mention a few other projects, and mention future developments and current status of everything. It's always nice to go back to the beginning. We all know that Pierre Auger is credited with having discovered air showers in the 1930s, and in fact, you go back to his nice little paper in 1938 in the compte rendu of the Académie des Sciences, back when French was good for something other than cooking, you could see some of the results he had obtained, where he had, for example, between two or three counters set on the ground, separated at distances from less than a meter up to 5 meters, and he would have in some cases lead on top of his counters, in other cases no lead. And he would account for accidental coincidences between his counters and subtract those off, but then count real events that were coincident in multiple counters, and deduct from this that there were indeed extended showers covering a large-ish area of ground, many meters apart. Now, one thing Auger did not know how to do, and we might argue we still don't quite know how to do that very well yet, is to go from the signals in these counters up to an energy of the incident particle that initiated the cascade of particles in the atmosphere. So based on the amount of lead that he had on some of his counters and the signals that he detected in his counters, he estimated that perhaps he was looking at something on the order of 10 to the 11 EV as the primary particle that created the air shower. So we're still struggling with these issues today, going from signals and counters to an energy at the top of the atmosphere. So nothing is new under the sun. So you all know that in studying ultra-high energy cosmic rays, you can either look at the cascade of particles as it hits the ground by deploying a network of detectors, and that has been used successfully over the years with different efforts, or else you could look sideways at the shower at the light excitation of the nitrogen in the atmosphere. And you can use both techniques. So you can either sample the shower front particles or look at the nitrogen fluorescence excitation. So the first method of sampling particles at the ground was used successfully in a number of experiments. Haver Park, whose erstwhile pioneer is here in the audience, Yakutsk, and then most recently Agassa, which holds the record, well, used to hold the record until Auger got bigger. And they have accumulated overall until 2003 with 100 square kilometers of detectors, a total exposure equivalent to about 2,000 kilometers squared years to radian. And then in these efforts, when you sample the particles at the ground over a large area, the problem is always how do you go back from what you sample to an energy at the top of the atmosphere. And that's highly model dependent. You have to rely on air shower simulations, and perhaps you can do this with an accuracy of about 25% or so, but that's debated. And the other technique is, of course, what Stefan described yesterday, looking at the shower on the side, looking at the excitation of the atmospheric nitrogen molecules. And then, in principle, you get an overall calorimetric measure of the total energy in the shower. The fly's eye pioneering experiment proved that this technique was possible, and we heard yesterday on Hi-Res, which as of now, I got these numbers from Stefan this morning, has accumulated about 5,000 kilometers squared years to radian in monocular mode and 2,500 kilometers squared years to radian in stereo mode. And there, the accuracy may be comparable to the ground array technique on the order of 20% or so. So we heard a lot about Hi-Res yesterday, so I thought I should also show Agasa. This is this air shower array in Japan covering 100 square kilometers, where the counters were distributed in schoolyards and people's backyards and in the metropolitan area. And here's one of their huts, inside of which they had a scintillation counter and various electronics. And they ran for a good many years, and you've all seen the spectrum. This is their final published spectrum, where they rescale by E cubed as usual. And they see a couple of handfuls worth of events at that energies beyond a nominal possible GZK cutoff here. So that creates a lot of excitement, but is being disputed. And of course, the other experiment at these energies is Hi-Res, where with two sites in Utah, Hi-Res 1 and Hi-Res 2, they look sideways at the shower and obtain a also measure of the cosmic ray spectrum. And Stefan spent a lot of time looking at anisotropies, or searches for anisotropies in the Hi-Res data. So I thought I would concentrate a little bit more on the spectrum today. And this is as of about 1999 or so. It looked at that time as though the Hi-Res results were in exact agreement with the Agasa results. There looked to be a superabundance of events beyond the nominal GZK cutoff. And at that time, to their best understanding, the atmosphere had an attenuation length of about 15 kilometers. And there was good agreement, and everybody felt good about that. And regardless of whether there was an agreement or disagreement, Auger was being proposed to measure the cosmic ray spectrum at the end, regardless of any possible disagreement between the two. Well, later on, the Hi-Res people decided that perhaps the atmosphere was more transparent than they had initially thought, and they went to 25 kilometers. So that changed the character of their measurements quite a bit. And in fact, there is now a disagreement. And I think much too much is being made of this. I think we all realize here that the two data sets are essentially compatible with a small amount of systematic shift in the energy of either reconstruction, sets of reconstruction, you can reconcile the two. But unfortunately, this has gotten a lot of attention, and people now have seized on this as being, you know, the major puzzle to resolve. Yes, please.
At one point, which I think was subsequent to this curve, Agasa revised specifically the relatively low energy part, like around the 18.5. So I thought this sort of steep rise that looked so, you know, strikingly out of
this one here.
Yeah, that was, I thought that moved down and was sort of flat.
No, that was 2002. I'm not sure when that was done.
Subsequent
here.
To that, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I'll show a couple of more recent plots, and I don't think those have changed substantially.
Do you remember that story?
Well, I mean, first thing I would say, I really don't like these JEQ plots, because unless one multiplies times in the error in the energy, you get a complete distortion of what the data are like.
Absolutely.
I'll show a log plot without the JEQ tomorrow. It's something like this case.
Well, okay, I'll show the effect of that in a second. If you rescale the Agasa energies downward a little bit, because of this rescaling by E to the third power, you can't get the two to agree very well. But so let me show that in a second, and we can discuss that. And then the Hi-Res collaboration has, at least in some of their papers, made the claim that perhaps they now see evidence for the GZK cutoff. But I would argue that whether the cutoff has been seen or not, these particles are extraordinarily interesting. They have extreme energies. We still have to understand where they come from. And they're not just interesting because of the possible discrepancy between Hi-Res and Agasa. They're interesting in and of themselves. So here, for example, is a claim that was made for a while by the Hi-Res collaboration that perhaps these energies, if they got reduced by 20% or so, the Agasa energies, then you would get good agreement between the two. And certainly, the Agasa people have agreed that there could be easily an energy shift in their measurement, in the determination, by as much as 25%. So shrinking their energies by 20% is not entirely outside the realm of possibilities, but they couldn't really see any real reason why they should do this. So as far as I know, they've stuck to their guns, and they still claim that this is their spectrum. I'm sorry?
This was a claim by, not by the high-res club.
Well, okay, by some people within high-res. And it's certainly a valid possibility worth exploring. And there are uncertainties associated with doing these reconstructions, certainly.
The claim was not the people of high-res club.
No. It was not? Okay, I thought I got this brought from a high-res paper, but I'm sorry if I misrepresented that.
We have no right to reconstruct.
Okay. Well, I see that this is now gone from high-res papers. Here's the most recent high-res distribution from one of their papers from just a couple weeks ago. And they certainly do not show the Agassa results rescaled, but they make the statement in the paper that if you do that rescaling, the two data sets are in agreement. And certainly there is a bit of a discrepancy, but as Alan pointed out, the E-cubed rescaling really further emphasizes things, and it shouldn't be taken too seriously. And on the other hand, I think it's fair to point that there are problems also, uncertainties associated with the nitrogen fluorescence reconstructions. A case in point might be this kind of an event that sometimes is shown as a typical high-res reconstructed profile of number of particles as a function of depth in the atmosphere. And your eye tells you that the best fit isn't really what's being fitted in this Geiser-Hillis profile, but you would prefer to have something that went further, a little bit higher up there. So,
what are those oscillations? I mean, there are 5 points in a row that go up, and then
well,
seven that go down.
I wouldn't begin to hazard whether this trend is real here, but I would argue that there are still uncertainties here. Most importantly, the fluorescence spectrum is itself a complicated function of wavelength, and it has to be understood very carefully. If one is able to extract from a signal at a telescope an absolute amount of light that was generated at the site of the shower, and in fact there are efforts being undertaken now to improve our understanding of the fluorescence spectrum of the nitrogen in the atmosphere.
A couple of years ago, a comment was made, if you went back to the original papers on which the fluorescence yield was measured, that they were in some sense not very satisfactory, and that there were plans being made to redo measurements.
But these plans are being enacted now.
There are still plans.
There are 10 different experiments measuring that right now, yeah.
But nobody's got new.
No, the results aren't out yet, as far as I know. So this is an area of active interest, and certainly has to be done. Another area where there has been and continues to be a little bit of disagreement between the two is, for example, this anisotropy distribution this sky map that Agassa has published, where they have seen clusters of events, possibly including one that they claim has a very low probability of being accidental. We heard from Stefan yesterday how this is completely compatible with chance, and Glennis is going to tell us tomorrow why this is wrong, and this is in fact a real source of cosmic rays. So it is an area of interest. But meanwhile,
and Stefan is going to bet me a trip to Paris and the opera.
So we're going to have odds here. And then meanwhile, high res.
I haven't. Don't let her track you. She's very high.
But I believe in my numbers.
Don't let her track you. She's very slippery.
She'll cash in on it too. She wins. So. Well, meanwhile, high-res has published their own distribution of arrival directions on the sky for their events. And it's complicated a little bit by the fact that their error boxes aren't circles like Agassa, but they're these banana-shaped ellipses. And I'm sorry?
For the monoculars.
For the monocular events. And in 2004, they published a result where they ruled out in their high-res 1 mono data point sources above 10 to the 19.5 eV. So that was in disagreement with what the Agassa people concluded. And they have now since done a combined analysis of both, and Stefan showed this yesterday, of the high-res and Agassa data, which is not trivial. They had to resort to this likelihood technique. For instance, one difficulty is you're really comparing apples and bananas here.
It wasn't clear to me in this combined analysis whether the Agassa group was fully cooperative in these, or you just sort of adopted
the results. No, we have, for Agassa, we don't have errors for individual events. We have that statement would be used for every event, the same era. So as long as we don't have individual errors for agnostic, we can.
So, you know, what I was wondering is whether they would agree that these are valid joint analysis or not.
I'm sure they would.
Well, here is the distribution that Stefan showed yesterday, and now the claim is that there are no point sources above 4 × 10⁻¹⁹ eV in this analysis of 57 Agassiz events and now higher-res stereo events. So what are we left with then? So far, there seem to be some events with an energy at least moderately beyond 10⁻²⁰ eV. They have been seen by all these experiments, but we're not sure of how many there are. The arrival directions of all these cosmic rays do seem to be isotropic, but there may or may not be clusters. So, and the problem, of course, is that the flux of these particles is so darn low, and the solution would be a much larger experiment done in a hybrid fashion, and that's where Auger comes in. So hybrid, in fact, Stefan showed this yesterday, the hybrid operation is simply a situation where you have the shower sampled at the ground and on dark, clear, moonless nights, simultaneously viewed with nitrogen fluorescence telescopes. So the guiding principle behind the design of Auger is that if we had 3,000 square kilometers instrumented of detectors on the ground and operated such an observatory for 10 years, by just some reasonable extrapolation of existing fluxes, we could in principle detect something in the range of 300 to 500 events above 10⁻²⁰ eV. So we could, in fact, measure the shape of the spectrum unambiguously. And if we are looking for point sources, the philosophy has been from the beginning to build two observatories, one in the southern hemisphere and one in the northern hemisphere. And the idea initially was to build the two of them simultaneously, and that was not successful with the funding agencies, and they told us to start with the south first, so that's what we did. We're well along here, and I'll show you how far along we are. And we are now discussing amongst ourselves plans for what we do with the north and where the northern site would go. Indeed, with two observatories in the north and the south at the latitudes that were chosen for the sites, you get pretty uniform full sky coverage of all possible sources. So this is the site in Argentina that's under development now. This is the town of San Rafael and the little town of Malargue here. And this total area is on the order of 3,000 square kilometers. And to give you a sense of scale, the distance from Malargue to El Sosneado here, a little white point, which isn't a town, it's really a cluster of houses, is 52 kilometers. So it's quite an undertaking. And the idea is that each one of these red dots represents a surface detector station. I'll show you photographs of these in a second. And there are four telescopes, nitrogen fluorescence detectors, telescopes, at the edges of the array located on hills that then look out over the site on dark, clear, moonless nights. And here's an example of one of these Auger detectors. We are building and deploying 1,600 of those. And these are water tanks. They're about 10 square meters in surface area and about a meter and a half deep, the water inside. And they are operating by themselves out in the field with solar panels and battery boxes. And they're filled with clear, pure, deionized water viewed by three photomultiplier tubes looking down into the volume of water. And the hybrid mode comes when you realize that there's a hill in the back there with a building on top with nitrogen fluorescence telescopes located in barrage bays that get open up on dark, clear, moonless nights and look out at the area over the array. So that's what we're building. The tanks are fabricated in South America in a number of places. They're made of roto-molded plastic resin that's then cooked and formed into the shapes that you see. They're trucked down to Malargue. And we have an assembly building down at the site where we prepare these tanks. Inside each of these tanks is a liner bag that is installed. Here it was inflated to check for leaks. And you can barely see here there are three transparent domes mounted on the bag. So the bag is inserted and these domes are made to line up with the portholes. And there's a phototube pressed down against each one of these domes looking at the clear, dark volume of water inside the tank. It has required extraordinary efforts to deploy these tanks, and we continue to deploy these in a regular fashion, so I thought it would be interesting to show how we do this. When these tanks have been prepared at the assembly building in Malargue, they get loaded on these semis. There are four of them at a time. The phototubes are inside. There's no water in these tanks yet. And they get transported as close to the site as we can with this semi. And from there, there are a certain number of survey roads throughout the site that were generated at the time of oil exploration in Argentina, and those trucks can go on these roads. But then, to get closer to the actual sites where the tanks are individually deployed, there's a smaller truck with a crane that then takes one tank at a time and brings it to the following, to its intended destination. Then the tank is laid down on the ground. The ground has been prepared in advance. It's been flattened out, smoothed out. There are some last minute checks that are done of the electronics. And then a water truck comes by. We have a plant in Malargue to clean up, deionize the water, purify it, and then we bring this truck out to fill up the tanks after they've been installed. And that's really the bottleneck for deploying the tanks, because we can produce so much water at a time. We have three, soon to be a fourth truck, I think, for the filling up those tanks. And that's what takes the bulk of the effort. As we deploy these tanks, it becomes increasingly challenging to take meaningful pictures because they're so far apart. They're a kilometer and a half apart. But here's a photograph where you can see one, two, three, four, and I think there's a fifth counter there, all lined up in a row. So it becomes challenging to take pictures. And the next one to the side is a kilometer and a half, so you don't see it on this photograph. So this is what those tanks look like when deployed in the field. We are, in fact, benefiting here from the heritage of Havre Park. This is a slide I got from Alan, where they operated water Cherenkov tanks out in the field for some 25 years. And at the end of the party, at the end of life of the project, they held a party where they opened up one of these tanks and they actually drank the water out of the detector.
Drank other things as well.
Well, it says here the water was quite drinkable, and I think that means nobody died from this, but I don't know if I would go any further. So there is, in fact, an existence proof for this kind of a detector to operate for a long time out in the field successfully. That's what we're doing for OJ. Now, given the fact that it has been such a challenge to deploy these detectors, I thought I would highlight a few of the problems we encountered along the way. First of all, our first tank deployment vehicle proved somewhat less than adequate to the task. This is almost not a joke, and I'll tell you why in a second. Here's another problem. We have lots of photos like that of a tank sitting out with the Andes Mountains in the background. They look rather pretty and scenic, but you see there's this nice little river that goes by there. And the problem is these rivers flood occasionally, and things get rather muddy very quickly, and our trucks get stuck in the mud all the time. We have to go pull them out. And in fact, early on in the project, some of the younger, more enterprising members of the collaboration took to trying to ride horses. That's why I say this is almost not a joke. To ride horses to the tanks in areas that were particularly muddy. And they stopped doing that when the horses themselves started getting stuck in the mud. So they decided that wasn't a good idea. There's another problem we've run into occasionally. We have these critters called vizcachas that are a protected national rodent of Argentina. And they're very cute, but they're rather destructive. They like to burrow and dig out incredibly ornate networks of tunnels. And they usually like to do that under rocks. The pampas are devoid of rocks. The next best thing are the OJ tanks. So we've had a couple of instances of these things creating large networks of tunnels under a tank, weakening the ground and risking the collapse of the ground under the tank. So we couldn't really do anything about it because they're protected. However, it turns out that their meat is a prized delicacy amongst the local gauchos. So even though we can't do anything about it, I know of at least one infestation that got taken care of by a carefully dropped word to the local gauchos, and the problem just went away. We never asked.
So we're not protected against local hunters?
Well, it's Argentina.
Don't ask, don't tell.
That's right. Here's another problem we've run into. The soil there is volcanic, and there are some pockets that have lava pockets, holes in the ground that sometimes open up. And sometimes trucks can hit a sinkhole, essentially, and get stuck. So here's an instance where the ground underneath sort of collapsed, and the truck had to be pulled out. There's a lot of cattle down there, and it turns out that there aren't very many trees out there for the cows to scratch up against. So they took to coming up to the tanks. For a while, we had cables going from battery boxes on the outside to the top of the electronics on top of the tank. And the cows would come up and scratch up against those cables and rip out the cables. So we quickly learned to make holes in the side of the tank and have the cables go in through there so that the cows wouldn't get as much of a good scratch out of them. And then more recently, we've also discovered that black widow spiders are taking to nesting in some of our electronics boxes on top. So an interesting set of challenges. The array has been under construction for a few years now, and as it's been growing, we've been running the various stations and collecting an ever-growing body of data. So here is an event from early on where we had some 40 tanks or so out in the field. And you see here the shower struck those tanks. Each circle around these tanks represents, the larger the circle represents the more, the greater the amount of light generated in the tank. And here we plot a distribution of the signal size as a function of distance from a core location, from the shower core. We fit an NKG type profile to that. And then from the geometry of the relative timing of the signals, we can extract the angle of incidence of the shower, 13 degrees in this case. And from the fit here, we can get an idea of the energy. And I should caution you that any energies I show on any of these sample events are to be understood as being preliminary. We're constantly revising how we understand the energy reconstruction. So here was an event that was about 10 to the 19 eV. In fact, if I go back to this event, one of the questions we had early on is trying to understand the signals. The shower core is this red dot here in the middle. So as a function of distance from the shower core, we wanted to make sure we understood how the signals look in the tank. And in fact, they look just like what we had predicted in all of our Monte Carlo simulations. So here are flash ADC traces of the signals at 458 meters from the core, further away, and then up to 1.7 kilometers from the core. And you see that near the core, the shower front is very narrow. Within 1 microsecond, essentially all the particles have arrived. And the signal is quite intense. There are a lot of, the counts here on the y-axis are quite high. And as you go further and further away, the y-axis numbers become smaller, but the signal gets more spread out in time. So as the electromagnetic shower hits the detectors further out, you see this increased activity. And you can maybe check out individual peaks due to muons plus electromagnetic activity. So these look just like the kinds of predictions we had from Monte Carlo simulations. Here's a high energy event that was recorded last year. This is an event that hit 34 tanks or so. It came at 60 degrees from the zenith. You see a lot of activity here, very good, great number of points with which we could do a reasonably reliable lateral distribution fit. And this event reconstructed through an energy close to about 10 to 20th eV, maybe slightly above. So we do see these events. We are in the process of tallying them up and trying to extract a spectrum out of them. But again, this is preliminary. The energy might be a little bit below 10 to the 20th eV. But we do see these events. They're beautiful. I should point out that in trying to understand these reconstructions, we have to worry about tanks such as this one, where there was no signal, despite the fact that tanks around it had a signal. So there are fluctuations we have to understand where signals sometimes should have been present that aren't. This tank was not operating at the time of the event, so that's why it's black.
Can I ask just, are you far enough out there so that that's just where the muons happen to go through?
You mean out this way? Or?
Yeah.
There's still electromagnetic activity out there. If you look at the if you look at the these guys, that's not going to be all just muons.
About 60 degrees, Stefan, and I think what Tom's suggesting is probably the explanation. At 60 degrees, the track length from muon tank is going to be rather long. It also has more chance to do directional and knock-on electrons. So the statistical fluctuations, which I agree we have to understand, are quite large.
And I'll show more highly inclined events later, and you'll see that these are just simply the muons by the time you get to the very large angle.
It's close to 60 degrees.
Close, that's where...
Yeah,
okay. And so in trying to understand these lateral distributions, there are a number of subtleties, and we have a number of efforts underway now to make sure we understand it at our likelihood reconstruction algorithms do take these subtleties into account. For example, I'm sorry you can barely see it here, but in green is a simulated lateral distribution profile of number of particle densities as a function of distance from the shower core for a 10 to the 19th eV proton-induced shower. And the ideal NKG type, Nishimura-Kamata-Grison type lateral distribution function would have followed the green curve, and here's the functional form for that. But because of fluctuations, especially out in the tails, some tanks fluctuate up, some tanks fluctuate down, and the individual threshold for any given station to fire is on the order of 3.2 in units of vertical equivalent muons, VEM. So any signals below that would not have triggered the local station. And you can see that there's a tendency for the smaller signals to fluctuate up and to skew the profile reconstruction here to the purple curve. So that when you do these reconstructions, even though the beta, which parameter, which determines the slope of this function, would have been initially 1.8 or so, it gets reconstructed to something less. However, the two curves meet at around 1,000 meters from the core. So this is a distance where, for a variety of reasons, we can make the estimate of the density of particles in a fairly reliable way. So in fact, S1000 for Auger is the parameter that we've been using in studying the overall density of particles as a function of distance from the core. Here's another example. The blue points represent signals as a function of distance from the shower core. And each of these curves represents a best fit for a fixed value of beta. And you see that if you didn't know beta, you couldn't fit it as part of this algorithm because for a particular event you had too few data points. And you did not know what the value of beta was. All those fits do meet at one point, which is at 1,000 meters from the shower core. So this value of S1000, the particle density is 1,000 meters from the shower core, is the most reliable parameter to determine for the geometry of Auger. And here's another one of the kinds of effects we have to worry about. This is the resolution with which we can measure this S1000 parameter as a function of distance between the shower axis and the nearest struck tank in the shower for Monte Carlo events at 10 to the 19 eV proton showers at 15 degrees. And you see that for those events where there was no saturated tank, so if the shower core falls too close to a tank, the signal is too great, can't be handled by the electronics, and there's saturation. For those events where the core fell far enough from the nearest tank, there is no saturation. For those events where the core fell closer to the nearest tank, within a few hundred meters of the nearest tank, then there is some saturation we have to worry about. And in fact, the accuracy with which we can determine this S parameter, S1000 parameter, gets worse when the shower core hits nearer a tank. So we have to worry about that, because ultimately, we try to use this S1000 parameter to extract the energy at the top of the atmosphere. So we have this nominal functional form, and we're still fiddling with that. This is based on a number of Monte Carlo studies with it. And the S1000 parameter is related to the energy, and the better we can measure this, the better we can measure the energy, and we have to worry about these kinds of effects. For Agassa, the geometry of the array was different, and they used S600 instead of S1000. And they had an estimate here, and this was their conversion formula for S600 to energy. And they had an estimate here by using various Monte Carlo models of a range of possible reconstructed energy values of the order of about 30%. The full extreme of the range of these models is about 30%. So this S600, or in our case S1000 parameter, is what gives us the energy. And how we do this conversion is subject to uncertainties depending on the Monte Carlo models you use. We have to worry about all that, and that's one reason why we don't have a spectrum yet. We're still understanding these issues.
About what fraction of the dots are red?
Oh, in this case, well, this is just dependent on how we did the Monte Carlo. This is Monte Carlo events. It's how many events we threw of each type.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so this is not real data. Okay, so it's meaningless.
I'm just wondering what fraction had a sensitivity
standard. Oh, you know, I don't know that we know that, but just from the geometry, it also depends on energy. This is a 10 to the 19 eV shower. For a 10 to the 20th eV shower, you can go further out and still have saturated stations because the signals are so big. But you have so many points to do the lateral distribution reconstruction that that's less of an effect. So all of this is energy dependent, it's angle dependent, so there's a lot of issues in trying to get it right.
Can I ask another quick question?
Certainly.
As I remember, the Agassa formula that they finally use is more complicated than the simple MKG. Is another factor in a lateral distribution function? Is there a particular reason you don't use that more complicated formula?
Well...
Well, we should...
Yeah, this is one formula we use. It's a parametrization of a number of Monte Carlo studies. And within ourselves, we argue about the value of that exponent. We argue about the form of that function.
We have this one, that going back further to the Lotto distribution function.
Oh, the NKG, we're arguing about that as well. So, yes, it's a matter of... I mean, it does do a reasonable job. All the sample events that I showed had an NKG profile to them. So it does fit what we observed rather well.
But as you showed in the picture of the different distributions, the value of S1000 you get is very robust.
That's right.
Against the uncertainties in the LDF, which you apply to use.
And that applies even when you change the function.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think you were planning on maybe giving a little tutorial on that very issue, but I guess maybe we'll do that privately in discussion. It's an important aspect of doing these reconstructions.
And it's also sensitive to the assumed composition?
No, not as much. Not for that S1000. It's actually one reason to use that. And of course, the other aspect of Auger is the fluorescence detectors. So here's again one of the four detector stations that we have, the fluorescence telescope buildings. This is seen from above. You notice there's a large antenna next to it. This is because the Auger tanks are so far apart and distributed over such a wide area that they can't possibly all be cabled up together. So each tank has its own little radio and its own antenna pointing to one of these towers. There's a tower next to each fluorescence detector. So everything is done by radio. So there's quite a task involved in making that work. So this photograph is taken from the tower. You see the six different bays of the fluorescence telescope here. And here are the insides of that building. The telescope consists of a segmented spherical mirror viewed by an array of phototubes, so a 440 phototube camera, each of which views 1.5 degrees on the sky. And we have complex optics here with a corrector lens to increase the aperture, the field of view. We have shutters and protection curtains and all kinds of things to protect the electronics. And here's an example of an event that was detected. You can see here the camera signal. We see all the various phototubes that were hit. And those that have a dot here, the trace from that is being shown here. So each dot represents a different trace. And you can watch the progression of the signals in time on the sky as a shower moves across the sky. So you can follow the triggered pixels and look at the flash ABC traces. And then you have to reconstruct from your individual phototube signals an amount of light detected as a function of time or as a function of position on the sky. And this is the raw distribution that you have then to correct for the contributions due to Cherenkov radiation. So this is not just nitrogen fluorescence. Some Cherenkov light will be irradiated directly towards the telescope, so we have to subtract that off. And some of it will have been scattered by the atmosphere. So we have to account for those two contributions, and Stefan mentioned how Hi-Res does that as well. And then when you're done correcting the raw data for these effects, you get this profile, now given in terms of number of particles as a function of depth in the atmosphere. And you fit this Geiser-Hillis form, and you see the fit is very good. And from that, you can extract an energy. This particular event had an energy of about 2.5 10 to the 18 eV.
What uncertainty would you assign to that?
20%, you know, it's the nominal thing. And we're again trying to determine that exactly. But you'll see in a second how much better we do when we do the hybrid detection and reconstruction. We also went to great lengths to deploy a battery of calibration systems for these fluorescence detectors right here in the middle of this, about equidistant from all of these three fluorescence detectors is a central laser facility that can be operated at night. Domes can open, you can fire off laser shots in the sky and then view the light from these different fluorescence sites and reconstruct and calibrate your telescopes that way. And now the power of Auger comes when we bring the two techniques together to bear on these events. So here's an event, a golden hybrid event. It's golden because it triggered simultaneously the ground array and the fluorescence detectors. So there are some events that trigger the fluorescence detectors but hit only too few tanks in the ground array to trigger the other detector. So this is a golden hybrid event. So it was a larger energy event. You see the pattern of triggered tanks here. And this was seen by one telescope at Los Leones. It spanned two different mirrors and camera systems. So this separation is arbitrary, so that you can see the trace there. And you see that the signals in the tanks are perfectly reasonable and adequate. These were muon signals. They're clear, sharp signals here. And here's a stereo hybrid event. We've started collecting those as well. So here was an event that was seen in the surface detector, triggered the surface detector, and simultaneously triggered two different fluorescence telescopes. It was a little bit far from this one, so the reconstructions aren't as accurate here, but this is a stereo event on a dark, clear, moonless night. There were 10 tags here triggered in the surface array, and a very good fit here, and a little bit less of a good fit there, but these are the events where we have the most information, where we can do the most accurate reconstructions. So here's an example of how well, or what we gain from doing the hybrid reconstruction. Here, for a sample of events, is a distribution of reconstructed energies from the surface detectors versus reconstructed energies from the fluorescence detectors for showers arriving at different angles. And you see that there's a clear correlation between the two. So the two are measuring the same thing. But we'd like this to be as tight as possible, so instead of just doing independent reconstructions, for those we can also do a combined hybrid reconstruction.
Why did the deviation at the...
What is going on down here?
The...
Yeah, that I couldn't tell you. I didn't do this plot. I didn't do this analysis.
You very often get that kind of thing, this kind of plot.
And you're getting down low here in the energy scale where things are not as efficient. I'll show later the range of over which Auger operates, and that's getting down low to below 10 to the 18 eV, or right around 10 to the 18 eV. So here's how the reconstructions are improved, for example. Here's a distribution of reconstructions of a particular hybrid event where each dot represents a different attempted core location. So this is the x and y coordinates of the projection at the ground. Of the core location assumed at the ground. And if you were to sample the core location in doing your reconstruction of your fit based only on the fluorescence information, so this is a MODO event, the best core location would have been identified as being here, the one that had the best chi-square for the fit. But this particular event also had a triggered surface detector. So there is information there, especially the time at which that tank was triggered in relation to that particular shower coming through. And if you take that into account, you end up with a modified best shower core location, which is here. And in fact, if you look at the reconstructed values of the angle of the shower plane with respect to the ground versus the distance of closest approach of the shower to the fluorescence detector, these various assumed core locations give different responses in this parameter space. But the standalone MODO solution would have given these parameters for RP and chi 0, but the hybrid fit yielded a different solution altogether, a much better solution. And in fact, when we look at the resolution with which we can determine this distance of closest approach and this angle of the shower plane relative to the ground, in MODO reconstruction versus hybrid reconstruction, you see a tremendous improvement where we go from about 900 meters for the distance of closest approach to In the case of 18 or 30 some events here that were analyzed, the resolution improved to 20 meters, and the angle improved from 8 degrees to 0.24 degrees. Those events weren't selected in any way, so in MODO mode, in general, we could probably do slightly better than this. But you see the power of the hybrid technique, the improvement you get.
So you didn't use the stereo aspect in this
problem? No, this is from about a year ago, and at that time we didn't have enough stereo events to
but
be able to do that.
Previous events you showed, you didn't analyze that.
No, we don't have enough of them ready to present to have a full, the further improvement you get by doing stereo hybrid events, yes. In principle, we know we're going to get these angles to a fraction of a degree now, and we're working out the techniques for doing that. So where we stand now is illustrated here. I apologize for the poor resolution of the plot. But as of now, we're April 05, we have deployed 793 of the 1,600 surface detectors, so about half of the array, of which 749 are fully functional. There are some that are still awaiting some electronics kits. So the array is about half built. And the area over which these have been deployed is highlighted in blue. There's a reason for the strange shape. The first fluorescent telescope we had built is the one down here, so the tanks started getting deployed near there so that we could understand hybrid events. Then this telescope got commissioned, so we started deploying tanks near there as well so that we could do more hybrid reconstructions and maybe even some stereo hybrid events. Then there was a dry period of time that allowed us to deploy tanks in this area between two rivers. And there was a serious concern that we might have difficulty accessing that area. So we took advantage of a dry spell to deploy tanks here and fill up that problematic gap. Then this particular fluorescence detector got commissioned, so now we've been deploying tanks out here. So the array is growing, but there's a method to this.
It looks like a congressional district.
Oh well, I don't know who these guys vote for. So at this point, these two fluorescence detectors are fully instrumented, fully built. Each has six telescopes operating. This building is built, and it has three telescopes operating. So a total of 15 telescopes are running. This site here is being prepared. There is a tower here. There is no building yet. So plans are being made to start developing that site. So more than half of the fluorescence detectors have been built at this point. The projection for completing the array are shown here. Let's see. The fluorescence detectors are sort of quantized because they are. So we are projecting that by about, what are we here, November of this year, we might have all the fluorescence detectors constructed. The surface detector stations are more continuous, so we are projecting now sometime in July 06, the final deployment of all the tanks. And this is an expected graph of the exposure of both Auger North and South together. Now, North doesn't exist yet, nor has the construction begun, so this may have to be revised, but you see how we fare relative to AGASA, which ended operation in 2003, HiRes, which is projected to take data into 2006 at some point. And then at this point, where we are, 2005, we have a few times the AGASA exposure already, and we're just now roughly comparable to HiRes, even with only half the array built. And this is the kind of spectrum we can expect to be able to produce after 20 months of operating the full Auger Observatory, where you can see the threshold effects that Alan mentioned. So those showers that were problematic are down here, where the array hasn't fully triggered yet. And then, of course, we don't know what's going to happen down here. But this is the size error bars we can expect to get. The targets for the performance of the observatory is that at 10 to the 19 eV, the array will be fully efficient. The threshold will be somewhere around 10 to the 18 eV. And we expect that for 10 to the 19 eV, in fact, we know now that there are on the order of six or more tanks that are struck. The energy reconstruction can be done at about the 25% level. The angular reconstruction for just the surface detectors alone would be on the order of 3 degrees, better for hybrid events. And for a 10 to the 20th eV shower, we'd have 12 tanks or more that would be struck, depending on the angle. The energy reconstruction is likely going to improve to the order of 15%, with also a corresponding improvement in angular accuracy. But of course, about 10% of the events on dark, clear, moonless nights will also have fluorescence information, so these figures will improve for that subset of the events. I guess I still have a few more minutes. So we're not talking about neutrinos this week, that's next week, but since Auger will have some ability in detecting neutrinos, I thought I would say a few words about that. We don't know where these UHE cosmic rays come from, and there are some models out there that they could be coming from top-down sources like the decay of topological defects, and I guess in 2 weeks we'll hear about that. And there is a prediction that perhaps at the highest energies, the flux becomes dominated by neutrinos, so it'll be interesting to look for them. And it's even possible that the flux of these particles extends to even far beyond 10 to the 20th eV in the realm of really ridiculous Greek prefixes like exa electron volt, zeta, and even yota electron volts. So it'll be interesting to see if that actually comes to pass. For Auger, the sensitivity to neutrinos comes by studying inclined showers. So a regular, ordinary cosmic ray shower that comes in at a large angle from the zenith would strike the atmosphere far from the array. Most of the electromagnetic activity in the shower will have been absorbed by the atmosphere, and only the hard muons will reach the array, so that the signals you can expect to see at the tank will be a thin shower front. All the particles will arrive within a short time, and they would be aligned in time to a plane very well. There won't be much shallow curvature here. So all the tanks would be expected to yield a signal that's quite narrow in time. In contrast to this, if you had a neutrino coming in at a large angle, in principle, it can interact deep in the atmosphere, creating a shower that then could strike the ground and yield a different kind of a signal in the tanks. You could have this electromagnetic activity that could last microseconds or more. And there, also, the shower front is expected to be thick, but also curved, as opposed to being a plane here. So indeed, we have done Monte Carlo simulations of these effects. Here's a simulation for a far shower, a proton-induced event, that strikes the atmosphere 100 kilometers away from the array at a large zenith. And by the time the shower reaches the ground, if the shower axis is along the north-south direction, so that's the shower axis, this is the distribution of muon densities you would get at the ground. And this is the distribution of time delays with respect to a planar shower front. You see, it's quite uniform, so all of these muons arrive together in a plane. If, however, the shower should be not north-south, but east-west, then there are geomagnetic distortions that you have to worry about of the shower front, of these particles as they come through the atmosphere. So in fact, the pattern would look quite different. So this is a feature of those highly inclined events, is that the Earth's magnetic field matters. In contrast, for a deep shower, a neutrino-induced shower that should interact 3 kilometers above the ground, so close to the array, by the time the shower reaches the ground, in addition to the muons, there's also a significant amount of electromagnetic activity. And the pattern of time delays of the signals in those tanks with respect to a planar shower front is no longer uniform, but there are some events that are quite delayed with respect to the assumed planar front. So in principle, it should be easy to tell the difference apart between this and something like the previous event.
What's the angular error in the neutrino events?
Well, it's going to be larger. It's going to be on the order of a couple of degrees, probably. You'll see an example of an actual event and what the effect of that angular reconstruction is in a second. And here an example is the distortion of the footprint of the shower at the ground due to the Earth's magnetic field at 80 degrees or 86 degrees. So this is all 80 degrees, this is all 86 degrees. It gets worse with the larger angles. This is if you don't turn on the magnetic field in Monte Carlo simulations, you get a nice circular spot of the ground. But when you do turn on the field, if the shower is in the north-south or east-west direction, you see that in some cases the pattern can be significantly distorted, and you have to account for that. And this is a function of energy, it's a function of angle, and all these things.
Is the field known well enough that that's not a source of,
it is a source of uncertainty. It is known to reasonable, it's known to better accuracy than other uncertainties we'll be facing in doing these reconstructions. So I think it's fair to say we don't quite know yet exactly how to do these reconstructions. It'll be some time before we are able to reconstruct them. In terms of extracting an energy, for example, from a neutrino-induced event that hits the ground, that's really iffy. And I'm not going to make any prediction yet on when we're going to have done that. Here's an example from a couple years ago of an event that came in at 83 degrees almost. So here the reconstruction, based on the fit, was about an accuracy of 1.2 degrees in answer to your question. So it's still, this is based on just the profile of times of these various detectors firing. This event came from 130 degrees in azimuth, so it just missed the top of the Andes by about a kilometer or so. So it did not come from the Andes, which would have been interesting because the Andes act as a nice target for neutrino interactions. So it came from above the Andes. There were some 8 tanks or so that had been triggered. And the patterns of hits in all these tanks was completely consistent with muon signals. So this was, in fact, a far shower, an ordinary, if anything can be called ordinary at these energies, an ordinary proton or iron-induced cosmic ray shower, not a neutrino.
In the tanks, are you sensitive to upward-going showers?
Well, there is some sensitivity, and that's where the tau-induced showers come into play. I'll mention that in a second. So if the angle is not too large, if the angle is skimming the ground surface, in principle you could detect particles, showers of particles coming out from the ground. Just to remind you, those are the muon signals we saw in this particular event. If there had been electromagnetic activity, this is for a separate event, we would have seen things lasting hundreds of nanoseconds, not 150 nanoseconds. So clearly those were muon events. For this particular event, we attempted some reconstruction, and we ran Monte Carlo simulations of a proton-induced shower, about 10 to the 19 eV, and various other energies. For example, if we had, instead of 10 to the 19 eV, we had a 20 eV shower, the green circles illustrate the kinds of trigger contours we would have expected for that event for an arrival direction of 81 degrees, 83 degrees, or 85 degrees. The preferred direction was 83 degrees, but what if there was some uncertainty of 1 or 2 degrees? You see that the trigger contour looks quite different. Even 1 degree makes a big difference. If the shower had been about 10 to the 19 eV, then we would have gotten these kinds of red contours instead. So that's the red curves. And then we also tried, the blue curves were 5 eV, and then the orange curves were 2.5 eV. So we could try and compare these various angular predictions and these various energies with what we have, and it seems that this one looks really unlikely. We had tanks fired quite outside of the trigger pattern that you would expect at these energies. So it's not likely that this was really an 85 degree event. The 83 degree, which was the best fit, does seem to yield a reasonable comparison between the contours and the actual pattern of tanks triggered, but we would have expected a few more tanks triggered out there that did not fire. So there are some surprises. There are still things we don't quite understand, but this is the beginning of how we would try to do the reconstruction of these highly inclined events. And I should say, because, before I say that, let me show the expected sensitivity to neutrinos that we could reach with Auger via the study of these highly inclined events. This graph is a compilation by Prothero from a few years back now of various neutrino fluxes you could expect as a function of energy from various sources. GZK neutrinos are in green, GRBs in red, topological defects here, and I'm sure next week there'll be all kinds of other curves shown. And if all neutrinos should turn out to be only electron or muon neutrinos, the Auger sensitivity is not very good. That would be the yellow curve here. However, if neutrinos oscillate into new taus, we have an increased sensitivity because the new taus can regenerate in the Earth. They interact, they create taus that propagate for a while, create more new taus. So there's an increased acceptance by looking down some into the ground for the new taus. And depending on what the neutrino interaction cross sections are exactly, we could get a sensitivity anywhere in that range. So if the most optimistic scenario comes to pass, we would have sensitivity to some of these sources, even possibly GZK neutrinos. If we should see no neutrino-induced events, no highly inclined events deep in the atmosphere after 5 years, this is the kind of limit we could set. So there will be some sensitivity here. One could guess at the rate of events one could see based on these various models. AGN-induced neutrinos, we could see a few tens per year. Topological defects on the order of 1 or 2 events per year. These other guys, GRBs, GZK neutrinos, again, it's at the bare level of detectability. And I should mention, since Alan is in the audience, that Havre Park was a nice prototype for us in studying these highly inclined showers. In fact, they did do this analysis a few years ago. Even though the Havre Park array operated up until 1987, over a 12 square kilometer area, there had been a body of events reconstructed or recorded at large zenith that had not been analyzed because the tools weren't sophisticated enough yet to be able to do that. So recently they did do that. They went back to their old data and did do a shower reconstruction for these events. And they discovered that there were significant uncertainties associated with taking into account the vertical location of the tanks relative to each other, the exact orientation and position of the detectors. So they did do an analysis recently, and I show two events here, one at 60 degrees and one at 74 or 75 degrees, and you see that the geomagnetic distortion of the footprint has to be taken into account in doing these reconstructions. At 60 degrees, it's not too bad yet. It's still pretty circular, but it gets peanut shape at 74 degrees. So they did an analysis of their measurements. They tried to do composition study based on their highly inclined events. This is the distribution of their numbers of events as a function of energy with an all iron composition or an all gamma ray composition or a proton composition. They had a resolution of on the order of 1.5 degrees, worsening to about 5 degrees at 85 degrees. Their energy resolution was perhaps 20%, worsening to about 50%, 10 to the 20th EV. So I'm not saying if I believe this or not, but I think it looks promising for Auger. There's at least one existence proof of an analysis that's been carried out for these highly inclined events, and there's a possibility there of doing that. The telescope array is another project that will be brought to bear on the study of these cosmic rays. It is under construction in Utah, scheduled, I think, still for completion in 2008. So it's an array of 576 scintillators deployed according to this pattern with three nitrogen fluorescence telescopes looking out at the array on dark, clear, moonless nights. So it's basically a scaled-down version of Auger. It's about one quarter the size of Auger. So it's really targeted not so much at expanding the body of knowledge at the highest energies, but in really understanding any possible systematics between the AGASSA and high-res reconstructions, with the possibility of perhaps further extending the reach of this array to lower energies by recycling the high-res mirrors at the end of 2006 into this array, and maybe bringing some AGASSA counters to infill the array. So that's a project that's underway. And if I should compare the Auger exposure to telescope array, we could guess something like this. So certainly, telescope array is targeted at a different science. And then, in principle, to do better than Auger, one might have to go into space. And with something like UZO or OWL or AirWatch, look at the dark sky at night and look at the showers from space. So although the fate of UZO is really up in the air. So I'm out of time. We still don't know where those cosmic rays come from. What's needed is the large increase in data that comes from just brute force sheer expansion of the scale of the detectors. That's what Auger does. We also need some fresh particle physics input to understand all these atmospheric models. There are some interesting new efforts. Auger is now collecting data. We're about to start publishing our first results this summer, making them public. We're going to be completing the southern site in 2006. We're about to make a selection now for the northern site of Auger, which will be either in Utah or Colorado. We're still debating that internally, and then going back to the funding agencies and trying to make the case for a northern site. So you can expect from Auger a definitive measurement of the spectrum, some sensitivity to point sources. There may not be any. There may be some. We'll see. We'll add our 2 cents worth. We have the potential for seeing neutrinos at these energies. In a regime that's really complementary to Ice Cube, we're really pushing the energy frontier higher, so it's not in competition with Ice Cube. And I didn't say anything about that. There's a prospect of doing composition studies too, largely based on the pattern of signals in the tanks, muons versus electromagnetic activity, for example. So that's something else that we'll have sensitivity to. And I guess I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Yes, please.
On the neutrinos, it seemed like, I'm curious, why do we know enough about neutrino oscillations, but why isn't it reasonable to just assume they all, that in that kind of pathway, you will have down neutrinos?
Oh, yeah, so that's what we assume. That's why we're.
But then why is there such a big, so you have this little sort of river shape, or I don't know, like.
This is a range of deep and lasting scattering cross sections here. So if the cross section is small, then you get less sensitivity. If the cross section is large, for the neutrinos interacting.
And certainly in the extrapolation of the
right
cross section.
That's where that's from. So that gives us the range here in that liver shaped box.
I think it's worth mentioning set boxes at point in rays that. The array is actually more sensitive to tau neutrinos because the tau neutrino, if it comes in below the horizon, it relates to the question that you asked. If it comes below the horizon at maybe 2 degrees, you can have an interaction of the neutrino with the rock. But the tau is sufficiently energetic at 10 to the 18 to get out of the rock, although its lifetime is whatever it is. And then
and decay in the atmosphere. Sure.
And that's why the limit is low. In the case of the ion neutrino and the electron neutrino, you're relying on an interaction of the atmosphere, and the mass of the atmosphere above the detector is obviously insignificant.
So that signal is just neon and electron neutrinos?
That's the yellow one up here. That's the limit, if there were no neutrino oscillations, but we know there are, so we can ignore the yellow.
So I'm still fascinated with the spectrum of 10 variation in cross section, apparently. I mean, due to the uncertainty of the oscillation. So what are the differences in these?
Oh, I can give you the references to that if you're interested. It's out there in the literature. I would hope that's the kind of thing that would be discussed next week.
Could you remind me what's oscillation length for these kind of energies?
Oh, goodness.
Not using your phone.
Yeah, well, if they're cosmological, all of these lengths are irrelevant by the time they get here.
Yeah.
I don't see that that's a concern. I'm worried about that.
But anyway, it's not going to be really oscillation, it's going to be more separation of the wave patterns of the types.
Yes, please.
The event rates that you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. But these guys here.
These are about what energy?
This is, I think, integrated over all energies.
Yeah.
The reason why these are so small is because they're outside of our range of sensitivity. They're too high.
Numbers probably about 10 to the
20. I could probably dig that up. I don't have them in my head, but if you're interested, we can try to figure it out.
So there's one figure where you showed data of the energy for the fluorescence in the air shower.
Oh, yes. The,
so I guess the implication is there's no calibration uncertainties between about 18.5 and 19.5.
Yeah, there is some uncertainty. I've seen a variety of graphs of that sort, and they don't all have a slope of 1. So we're still understanding the individual, this one, what you're talking about there.
Yeah, so is that within 20%?
Yeah, that's roughly the kind of resolution we're talking about, 20, 30%.
Looks worse than 20%.
Yeah.
That's Chuck's question.
Yeah, okay, you have to really, those are all big points, so the density is hard to estimate. If you were to draw little dots, the density might be greater than the other core. So I don't know what it is here. Again, we could figure it out, but I don't have
to. 10 to the 18th to 10 to the 19th, you're getting good, pretty good intercalibration between the two. Is that what I'm supposed to take from this?
Yes, that the two techniques do yield agreement.
But what about entire energies?
This was a sample of hybrid events that was used for some, and I don't know that we had any of the higher energy events available yet. And there's a couple of points here. But this is a preliminary study.
So the spread of a factor of 10, you're saying, is misleading?
The spread of a factor of 10 in here?
Yeah.
I think it may be because of the size of the point that we're used to plot. Yeah, but this is a scatter plot, so the density of points is arbitrarily enhanced far away by having those plots, those dots being big. So it's hard to tell from this what the density is near the middle. If we were to project this and then get the Gaussian distribution of that, I don't know how fat it would be. But
Stefan's in a very difficult position because he's not allowed to show all of them the spherical in the picture. And all I can say is that the picture that will be shown that will be available on the 3rd of June will be very different from this.
I'm not even allowed to say that, but you're the spokesman.
So this is what we're going to be a teaser.
No, the reality is in any big collaboration, you cannot release the results piecemeal. And what Stefan is showing is results of, I forget, 6 months or a year from now.
Yeah. And individual studies that have been done by people. And it's just to show, really, this is the point there, that there is a correlation between the two. And that they agree at some level, but the details of that are not finalized.
This is what we'll be paid for.
If you look at the talk by Bruce Dawson on the LEEDS website, reading the LEEDS website last July, it's a very nice, how the hybrid events are very beautiful, consistent. I don't know why that's
public. That's the guy who just heard from
now.
No. Bruce knows better.
You said the 30th of June, which is
like the day of submission of the papers for the ICRC, you can't have the data embargo, the papers embargo, until you think the collaboration of the site that makes sense of it.
Why wouldn't you travel to Pune? It's got to be a wonderful place.
Oh, it's fabulous. Right?
Yeah.
I think if it had a parking plan, showers were protons, nuclear treatments, or
there were nucleotic primers.
The main goal was
they were not gamma rays.
I was a little disappointed that she didn't say anything more about the composition, the power of the thing to do composition, either from the waveforms or from the spectral maximum.
Yeah, on the scale of priorities of problems we're tackling, that one is a little bit further down. Because it's harder to do, and it's highly model dependent, and we're trying to focus on the spectrum, on the anisotropies first. I think that's a fair statement.
Maybe Alan will talk about that tomorrow.
We haven't actually decided if we'll present an elongation rate, which is get the maximum as a function of energy, but we'll decide that in the meeting of the June. But I'll talk about the techniques and where I think we will be able to go with those a little bit tomorrow.
No, step on. You had a simulated plot of data?
Oh, I had lots of simulated plots.
What was expected from Auger for the spectrum after a few years?
Oh, yeah. This one.
Okay. Well, if that were multiplied by E cubed or something, what's the uncertainty you can expect to get this sort of trough at the ankle to really fix an energy with
Yes, you may be talking about the second knee or...
No, the trough, the ankle.
The ankle.
The ankle energy. How precise do you expect to get that with 20 months of day?
I don't know the answer to that. First of all, we have high reluctance within the collaboration to get these E cubed spectrum plots. So we're probably going to show more things like that. But the hybrid events will have very good energy resolution. So in principle, with those, we could get a better measurement, better handle on the spectral details. But that's going to be longer in coming because the rate is not as high. I don't expect that this summer we'll be showing detailed spectral features yet. So it's going to be a little while before we do that.
The lower end of the curve really shows your exposure energy dependence.
Oh yeah, right here.
So how?
That depends on the favorable location of the shower core with respect to the tank.
How would this energy dependence be?
Well, it's one of these areas where there are several groups within Auger trying to understand what is our aperture and how do you define trigger hexagons and what is our aperture at any given time. The fact that the array is growing with time too. The aperture changes constantly. So it's a struggle to keep track of all these things. But yes, in principle, we have ways of accounting for that. And our spectrum will extend down to these energies and will account for this fact. So we will correct for these things. And I've seen preliminary spectra that don't show a weird effect all of a sudden because of lack of understanding of the aperture. We know how to do that.
So it can change a bit. You can change the power.
It can change a little bit if
anything strange.
Sure, if there are some uncertainties, there are systematic effects. Yes, in principle, you could bias things. So that's why we're very careful about that too. So somebody, I think yesterday, said Auger seems to have too many people. It's an overly large collaboration, and I don't see it that way. There's so many things we don't understand, and I think we need all the people we have.
Okay, well, maybe we should wrap up. And,
okay, thank you.